Hello, this is Dr. Flavio Guzman. I'm the editor of the Psychopharmacology Institute. Today, Dr. Joji Suzuki is here with us to comment on the most important news of 2017 regarding opiate addiction and its treatment. Dr. Suzuki is the director of the Division of Addiction Psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. He's currently assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. In this brief audio, you'll learn about injectable buprenorphine, a new device called the NSS2 bridge, and proposed changes on buprenorphine prescribing regulations. Dr. Suzuki also shares new information on how some people are consuming fentanyl without knowing about it. Dr. Suzuki, what can you tell us about the latest buprenorphine formulations?
They're both injectable formulations of buprenorphine. They were both given the green light by the FDA advisory committee, and my understanding is that both will be approved and hit the market. One of them already was announced. Brand name is Sublocade. It's a monthly injectable depot formulation of buprenorphine, and it's really designed for patients to be on this medication for the entire duration for the month, and so that this eliminates the need for daily adherence to the sublingual tablets. The second one that's coming out and also was approved by another company is the weekly and monthly injectable formulation. So there's two companies coming out with these long-acting injectable buprenorphine formulations. They both should be available in the United States market early next year. And I think there are many reasons for this formulation being an important option for, I think, clinicians and patients. The most important one being that it eliminates the need for daily adherence. You probably know from everything else we do with pharmacology, it only works if you take it. And for opioid use disorder, it is a very common scenario where patients stop taking their sublingual buprenorphine and then relapse. And, you know, this injectable formulation really reduces that likelihood. Now, that said, I think another reason why the companies really went ahead and developed these formulations is that from the prescriber's perspective, one of the barriers to prescribing sublingual buprenorphine has been that prescribers are worried about diversion. And what I mean by that is that they're worried that their patients are going to sell or give away their medications, trade for other drugs, etc. There's a thriving black market for buprenorphine in the streets. However, we strongly believe, based on the available evidence, that the diversion of buprenorphine is largely driven by lack of access to treatment. So even now, it's extremely difficult for many patients to access buprenorphine treatment. So I'm in Boston. You know, we're lucky that we have a lot of prescribers here, but even here, we struggle to connect patients to prescribers. And so because of this lack of access, diversion is thriving. There's people who are desperate for this medication, and lots of patients actually use this on their own by buying it on the street. Now, that said, we don't think diversion is good and diversion should not be condoned. It is hurting ultimately the patients. So the injectable formulations is thought to maybe make it more likely that prescribers are more willing to prescribe it. I'm not necessarily convinced of that. I think in the available sort of research done already before this was released, it does suggest that the injectable formulations are probably as good as the sublingual. And again, by taking away the adherence issue, it may be better for some patients. But I'm not necessarily convinced that this is going to push the prescriber who's been reluctant to do buprenorphine into now prescribing it. Again, if that happens, that's really wonderful, but I'm not going to believe that until I see it. There are many, many other barriers for people to prescribe buprenorphine in the first place. Cost issues and resource issues and expertise issues or the fact that the stigma against these patients. I just don't think that this formulation alone is going to necessarily solve it. However, it's great that we have another option. First, it's going to be probably cost prohibitive for now, but as the costs come down and potentially other formulations hit the market, I think this is overall a good thing.
Now, in more practical terms, what type of patient do you think is more likely to benefit from these formulations?
Where I feel like these injectable formulations can really play a big role and have an impact is not the stable patients who are already on sublingual and looking to transition to the long-acting. I really think that it's going to really shine with patients who are not yet stable and are struggling. So people who are newly being initiated on the buprenorphine, and a good example for me is, you know, I'm largely a hospital-based addiction psychiatrist. We meet every single day patients who are admitted to the hospital for medical reasons, complications from their IV drug use, like endocarditis, spinal abscess, epidural abscess, overdose, etc. They were there because they were sick, you know, medically sick. But at that moment, when you're sitting in the hospital bed with a bad medical complication, I think it makes people contemplate more about their health and mortality and what they'd like to do to make themselves healthier. And it's a golden opportunity to engage patients into treatment. The problem, of course, is that as soon as they leave the hospital and they feel physically better, they're back in their old environment, and it's hard to maintain that motivation for treatment. It can be kind of fleeting. And so that's a perfect opportunity to start patients on long-acting formulation so that the adherence issue is less of a concern, so that when they leave the hospital, for the duration that the injection is effective, they're covered and they're protected against relapse and overdose, etc. And their cravings are well controlled and they're not going into withdrawal. So I think it could play a really big role in those kinds of patients who are presenting to acute care settings because of complications from their drug use. And maybe less so for like addiction clinics, where they already have a program where they have plenty of patients coming into seeking sublingual formulations. And then for the non-specialists, the primary care docs and other programs, again, if they're not ready to or capable of doing sublingual buprenorphine, it's not clear that they'd have the resources to implement long-acting formulations. Because the other problem with long-acting versions is that you don't just write a prescription and the patients go pick it up. For the sublingual tablets, you can do that. You can write a prescription, the patient goes to the pharmacy, fills it, and begins taking it. Long-acting formulations cannot be done that way. Just like the long-acting naltrexone, when the clinician writes a prescription, the medication has to be sent to the clinic or a specialty pharmacy, and then delivered to the clinic, and the clinicians have to prepare it, bring the patient in, and then deliver the injection. So the implementation of long-acting formulations is actually quite more complex and requires a sort of a institutional commitment to making it happen. And I guess I'm just not convinced that the typical non-specialist is willing to go through those hoops to implement it when they weren't capable of doing the sublingual formulation.
Last month, we're recording this in December 2017. Last month, the FDA granted marketing authorization for an electric stimulation device called the NSS2 Bridge. What are your thoughts on this device?
I think it's an interesting idea. It's electrical stimulation that seems to reduce opioid withdrawal symptoms or the severity. I mean, I think it's a good thing. It's just not clear to me clinically where that fits in. I know that the studies for the NSS2 bridge was a bridge to medication treatment. So you come off the opioids, you put on this device which helps reduce the severity of the opioid withdrawal, and then you transition to medications anyway. So for buprenorphine, you would just go right to buprenorphine. I don't think I want my patients sitting around with no coverage. It's one thing to reduce withdrawal symptoms. That's one thing. It's another thing to reduce cravings and other things. And I think that the device seems to maybe reduce cravings also, but the definitive thing is to simply go directly to buprenorphine. The place where I feel like the device could play a role is in settings where, you know, those medications are not available or prohibited, or, you know, for whatever reason, not available, or you're transitioning from illicit opioids to naltrexone. Because for naltrexone, you have to go through a 7 or 10 day period of complete abstinence from opioids. That's actually one of the challenges of getting people onto naltrexone. And therefore, if you use a device as a bridge, it may make it easier for people to stay off of opioids during that period of time. So I think that's where I feel like it could play a role. But if you're using methadone or buprenorphine, it's not clear, you know, why that device is really needed.
So I heard you have some interesting ideas about how physicians qualify to prescribe buprenorphine in the US. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
In the United States, currently, the only way to get people able to prescribe buprenorphine is to complete the waiver training. The law that was passed that put that into place was the DATA 2000 law and implemented in 2002. It's 15 years ago. And 15 years ago, the waiver training made a lot of sense because most physicians had very little training in addiction treatment, and this additional 8-hour course was a safety mechanism to make sure people could practice safely. But 15 years later, with the opioid crisis still worse, getting worse each year, and the number of waivered physicians it's increased, but nowhere near where we need it to be. I truly believe that the waiver trainings have become a barrier in itself, because in our institution, we actually strongly encourage as many physicians to complete the waiver trainings as possible. The reality is it's very difficult to tell a busy clinician to take time off of work and take this training for something they don't really want to do anyway. But my position, and there are people who agree, there are people who disagree. But my personal opinion and what we're trying to work with the state and at the federal level is to eliminate the need for waiver trainings completely. And how do we do that? We want to make every medical student in the United States get the necessary training in addiction treatment, safe prescribing of controlled substances, and pain management, so that on day one that you graduate from medical school in the United States, you should be able to apply for the waiver because you've gotten the necessary education as a medical student. There's really no other common illness that we treat where physicians are required to take an extra course to be able to treat. We need complete overhaul and reform of graduate medical education so that everybody has the basic competencies around addiction treatment. Doesn't mean they're all experts. I think we still have a need for fellowship training and addiction experts and all of that. But, you know, we expect every physician who graduated medical school to have an understanding of how to treat hypertension, diabetes, you know, how to perform CPR. And we can no longer say that opioid use disorder is something that you opt in for additional training. Everybody should get that. If you choose not to do it in your practice, fine, you can opt out of it. And then we should include nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and other allied health professionals so that they are also given the adequate training in their schooling as well. Brown Medical School, which is in Rhode Island, became the first medical school to actually adopt this. And those students graduating from medical school are able to apply for the waiver when they get their license because they got the training in medical school. The medical system has to take ownership and responsibility for treating addiction. It can no longer say it's somebody else's problem. The opioid crisis in particular, because it was at least in part caused by the medical system itself. So therefore, it is irresponsible if you continue to pretend like this is somebody else's problem.
Finally, are there any other news regarding the opioid epidemic you think clinicians should know about?
In the United States, in the last year or two, the fentanyl crisis has gotten worse. Not every part of the country, but in our area in the Northeast, in New England, fentanyl is wreaking significant havoc. And so we're working very hard to educate both clinicians and patients about the dangers of fentanyl. There are too many cases of, for example, teenagers or young adults who are experimenting with prescription opioids, you know, on the street. Kids will experiment with drugs. That's the reality. We know that's going to happen. But, you know, it's one thing to try one pill of Percocet. I mean, there's a lot of risk associated with that, and that's dangerous, and we don't want, you know, I don't want young kids even once trying Percocets, but I know that it happens. What's different now is that that same kid who might try that one pill of Percocet, that Percocet may turn out to be only fentanyl. It's a counterfeit pill that's made to look like Percocet. And the dealers themselves may not know that this is a counterfeit pill. And sometimes these pills contain massive amounts of fentanyl because it's so easy to miscalculate and have the wrong amount in it. And that one pill can contain enough to overdose that kid. And this is happening too many times. So it's playing Russian roulette. Again, there was a time maybe 5-10 years ago where if you bought a Percocet on the street, it was probably Percocet. But you can't say that anymore today. And so even once, it can be a deadly choice.
That was Dr. Joji Suzuki summarizing some of the most important opioid addiction news of 2017. If you're a premium member of the Psychopharmacology Institute, you can access his complete presentation on opioid use disorder. To learn more about premium membership, you can go to psychopharmacologyinstitute.com/premium, or you can just Google Psychopharmacology Institute premium membership. Thank you for listening.